Recorded at Get a Grip Studios in Toronto, Canada. A Get a Grip Management production and in association with the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast. Financially supported by the good folks at the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors, this is Restoring Darkness podcast.
This episode of Restoring Darkness is brought to you by Evluma. If you're serious about contributing to the reduction of light pollution, go to evluma.com, hover over products, and click on Dark Sky Friendly Lighting. Both the OmniMax and ArriaMax lights are International Dark Sky Association certified. The warmer color temperatures of the OmniMax reduce the more easily scattered blue wavelengths, which contribute to glare and sky glow. With ArriaMax lights, you get full cutoff, which also means no uplight and a significantly reduced contribution to sky glow. And all of Evluma's outdoor lighting product lines come with dimmable drivers for even more control. If your customer is looking for dark sky friendly fixtures with energy savings while still meeting the demands of decorative lighting, look no further than Evluma. Evluma, illuminating the pursuit of dark skies.
Welcome back, folks, to the Restoring Darkness podcast and video show, actually. On today's show, we have Sabine Frank. Since her childhood as an amateur astronomer and active in nature and species conservation, she became fed up with, ready for it, male astronomy. Using a lot of techniques, she developed star guiding tours that include the nightly landscape, the moon, night clouds, which are very special, mythology, invisible things, and all sorts of issues about the darkness. Studies in social and cultural sciences, she's a pioneer and initiator of the IDA Dark Sky Reserve Sternberg Park Rhone. I got Rhone. There you go. She's going to correct me how to pronounce that. Now coordinator and official dark sky officer of this park for almost 10 years. She specializes in public relations, star guidance, and most of all, here's a nice term, de-illumination. Sabine, welcome to the Restoring Darkness podcast. It's such an honor to have you here.
Hello. Very nice.
So I want to unpack this. I've often felt that, in our modern culture and maybe, with respect to, our egotism and that of how great we are, we've forgotten the realms of the male and the female. Or feminine and the masculine. And you're talking about male astronomy. Tell me about the difference between male astronomy and female astronomy.
Well, I can probably relate from my personal history with astronomy. The thing was, I was never keen on telescopes because they were just like too heavy to carry. I mean, These days it's changed a lot, but when I started, I only knew men doing astronomy, and I only knew men using telescopes and cameras and a lot of equipment. And I just found this very kind of, well, not boring, but it took a long time to set it up and to adjust it and all these things. And so I really got bored of that quite. And then the ocular was like missed it and all these things. And then I realized something. I realized that kind of people get detached from the night sky by technology, even in hobby astronomy. So the thing was, you could only go to like an observatory, and if there was like clouds or if there was like some mist, the show just stopped. So they would say like, okay, we can't do anything, and then might like grab some satellite pictures or something like this. And I thought, this is just not. This can't be astronomy. Astronomy just means like you are waiting for like a hole in the clouds, or you just walk around, you hear noises, you can feel how the air gets cooler, how the air gets more moist, and it gets more quiet. And I think with all this technique, and all these aspects just got lost. So I was like a bit fed up and called it just male astronomy. And I put it in my head to create a female astronomy.
I think a better term is the masculine and the feminine rather than male and female, because I think I'm 51% masculine and 49% feminine. you know, in my sensibilities or whatever, if you're to classify them. And I much prefer your brand of astronomy. And I often, when people ask me because of the show, I tell them, you know, it's, you can do a lot just with a pair of binoculars. If you want to get closer to the stars, lying back on your back in a field or on a dock or something and just using binoculars, it's a lot less clunky and it's quick and easy and you can rest into the experience a little bit more. I also agree with you, and I want to unpack this a little bit more, that it's that the movement, the dark, International Dark Sky Association, even the name, and I love what those people do, but actually what we want is bright skies and dark earth and dark water. It's not dark skies. We want bright skies at night, filled with stars and the moon and all this sort of
natural
stuff.
Natural bright skies.
Exactly. And so we've often adopted the terms darkness preservation, darkness restoration, night preservation, night restoration as a better description of what the movement is about. I want you to tell me how the feminine or the female for you is more naturally embracing that, that aesthetic of the feminine embraces the holistic picture more. Why is that?
It might be because women just like to talk more. Mm. Yeah. And there's much more to the night sky than just like looking at deep sky objects. And that, I mean, like with this, as I just said, the way you receive, how the air changes, how the light changes, and also the stories like the night sky tells us, especially in our European culture, meaning, for example, Greek mythology. Mm-hmm. And I know from my male astronomy friends, they really don't like telling these stories because they find them tacky or too girlishy or whatever, because there's always a lot of lovey-doody-doody in these things. And to me, I don't exclude anything of this. And I like poems. There's so many poems related to darkness, to the stars, to nature, and I include them in my astronomy.
And when you're talking, so you're, let's say you're pointing out Orion the Hunter, for example, and you see his belt and you point out to him, and do you talk about the mission that he's on when up in the sky? What do you do with that?
Well, I combine that. I maybe have to turn the time a little bit back. When I started off, and as I said, I was like, oh, it's just only telescope, telescope, telescope. Mm-hmm. And my mission was actually to show people just the natural darkness without any equipment, even without binoculars, just like the naked eye. Mm-hmm. And so I needed to tell also stories, just walking around with people and not just having some high-tech stuffy with me. And that's how I created my way of doing star guiding tours. And just like saying Orion, what I try to do is obviously the visibility of Orion and its belt. And then I tell, of course, his, him being after the Pleiades, the seven sisters, for example, but mm-hmm. also I always have a bit of deep sky stuff with me and binoculars, and then I try to make people just see what I can see with a naked eye, and then I show pictures of the Orion Nebula, and I tell them about star forming, for example. So I try to combine it.
Hmm. Do people pay for these tours? Is it a paid service or is it the park covering that for its guests?
No, they have to pay. Well, they pay for that. But when I started off, they didn't pay for that. When I started off, and that's the funny thing, I grew up very close to the East German border, very close on the western side of Germany. Mm-hmm. But very close to the border. And people living close to the border, there is just nothing. There's not a lot of destruction. But what we had always is a beautiful night sky. And obviously, we shared the same night sky on both sides of the border, of the fence. And what I really find astonishing is that although we live so in such a natural darkness, not many people looked up to the stars. Mm-hmm. So I sometimes get asked, why did you get into astronomy? And I got into astronomy because of the Halley comet. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I was a child. Sure. But I was the only one getting into it. And I find that really funny that people living in the countryside don't look to the stars. And so after a couple of years, me doing star guiding tours, and I really have to say it was really hard to get people coming. I had to do a lot of effort to really convince these countryside people, hey, it's just not only we have a natural and beautiful daytime landscape, we have a very beautiful nightscape landscape. So I find it really hard to convince them. And after a couple of years, I noticed that stars started to vanish at our night sky. And that's how I got into light pollution. Beforehand, I didn't even think about light pollution, because living so rurally as I did. Mm. And then once we got our designation as an International Dark Sky Reserve, that was the moment when people got interested into star guiding tours. But beforehand, it was really very difficult to get people coming to the star guiding tours, because they just had a very, how can I say, it's very abstract. They had a very lack of what is that, walking around in the night. I might fall, I might get eaten by a wild pig or whatever. So there was a lot of concerns. And I still find that funny that people living in the countryside don't notice the beauty of the night sky.
Yeah, it does strike me as strange.
I find it very strange, because all my schoolmates, all my friends, we all lived in the same place, but nobody looked at the stars. So it was just me, basically. And then when I started doing my star guiding tours, what I just did, trying to combine mythology, the wonder of the night sky, the way the sky changes from the blue hour to plop, 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 stars plopping up, as I like to call it. And yes, and then when I noticed it was the beginning of like light pollution, really. That was like after the war fell, and our region moved from being on the east end of West Germany, suddenly moved into being in the center of Germany. Mm. And that caused a very big change in our region, being suddenly in the center of Germany, and a lot of business settled around this area. And that was when light pollution started. And then when I noticed for the first time light pollution and stars vanishing, I really was like, I'm very headstrong. And I thought, I need to give the people here a star virus. Mm. And and that's still my mission. I really want people to sit in their gardens and just look up, even in the countryside. And I'm very glad that it happens now. The people are calling me and saying, you actually showed me that we have a beautiful night sky, and they get into it.
People have lost, like humans have lost their connection to the sublime because of this. There's almost like I believe that there is a psychological imbalance that is like a mass event. And I think it has to do with, I've talked about this in earlier shows before, where there's something about a beautiful star-filled sky that you're looking at, which centers you and which gives you a sense of meaning in life. And I don't know why it does that, but it does. And we know that all of our ancestors would have experienced this sense of awe on a routine basis. And all of our literature and all of our history of all cultures, all peoples, everywhere in the world, there is this connection to stars. You see it everywhere. Even the naming, they have different constellation names for the stars in India and China, and they have their own mythology about it. And I mean, the peoples of the Pacific Ocean, I can't remember what they're called off the top of my head, but they sailed across the ocean using stars. Dead reckoning in stars. And so, you know, this relationship, the pyramids are built to align to the stars. Like, all of this is deep in our history. And I feel like that lost connection is perhaps causing us some kind of problem that we can't put our fingers on now. And it seems to be a creeping, increasing problem. And that's where I think this de-illumination piece comes in for you. Tell me about your efforts with what you call de-illumination.
Yes, I will do that in a second. But beforehand, I'd like to say that I'm not that sure if people looked to the skies and to the heavens because of my experience living in the countryside. And I asked in my family, I asked my grandmother and I asked if she knew if her grandmother looked to the skies, and then none of them ever did. So I really find this funny, knowing at the same time all of these cultural assets we have, obviously, with the night sky. And still these days in culture, the night sky is... how can I say, engraved? Just listen to all these songs and poems, and there's always sky, moon, night. So the night obviously is sexy, it's calming, it's inspiring and all these things. Yes, and that really, why am I a de-illuminator? What am I doing? So I noticed that the stars are vanishing, and it really got me. And at the beginning, I'd never heard of light pollution because of living so rurally, and anyway, and but I was like a kind of detective. I mean, today you can like Google for light pollution if you find a lot, but at this time it wasn't like that. And I thought, where have these stars gone? And I mean, it was the zodiac star sign of the Capricorn, yeah, because that's very low to the horizon. And I remember that a couple or the year before, I could see all stars of it. And suddenly there was some missing, and I know the night sky very well. So I was like really upset about it. And then I found out it's light pollution. And and it really, really bugged me a lot. And then I think in 2009, I read about the first dark sky reserve in Europe. That's the Galloway and dark sky place in Scotland. And at that moment, I knew my area, which is a beautiful mountain range. It is very beautiful here. It's called Rhön. And Rhön, exactly. And it's very hilly, but we don't have a lot of wood here. So we have a very far sight, as we call it. We call it the land with open horizon. So it's just like you go onto a hill and you have a very, very beautiful view. And so I really got into our region becoming a dark sky reserve, which we did 2014. And then I think my boss realized this is something really cool, and he created my job. So I'm a full-time night sky officer. And my de-illumination plan is, first of all, to raise awareness, obviously. Secondly, to reach the hearts by going with people into the night. And you know what's really funny? One experience is, and that just shows how we got into our, well, how we create our life, that people say at the end of the star guiding tour, I didn't even know one can walk without light.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I believe that.
Yeah, totally. And when I heard it the first time, I was like, what? Yeah. So that was like really a very funny experience for me. And what my mission really is to, to reduce light pollution. And my advantage is that I work in an authority. So I'm not like in a nature conservation association, like an NGO. I work in an authority, and working in an authority, you can publish like planning aids and all these things, and they have a big value, especially in Germany. You have a lot of advice and how to create light so it's not so harmful. But at our place, there is like, it comes from an authority. And so it is more like serious.
Do you have enforcement powers? Can you write somebody a notice to change their lights and say that you're not in compliance with this?
Yes and no. One advantage of my job is that I can spend a lot of time looking at a legal situation, the law, And now I'm really firm and really good with law. And that enables me to write letters and use the law in a way. But obviously I can do that without my colleagues. And I think it's the same in Canada or in the US. Things which have been installed, they are granted by the Constitution. It's really hard to get into private people's area, yeah, mm-hmm. unless they break the law. And we have some laws with light. So it's not allowed that your neighbor blinds you or these things. These things are not allowed. And then you can actually enforce.
Yeah. So light trespass. I think light trespass. Exactly. Is enforceable. Like you can enforce a light trespass on somebody and say, you know, hey, your light is spilling onto my farm. I live in the country as well. I live in a rural area. And to the southwest of me is a massive glow of the city of Toronto. And you can see it. It turns into like a purple haze on the horizon. But to the northeast and to the north and to the east, there's very little light. So you see, like, you can really see the effect of light pollution where I live and how the stars fade into nothing as you turn towards Toronto. But so you actually can make people change their lights on a light trespass order or something like that.
To a limited amount.
Yeah. More of a suggestion.
Like for example, with a trespass, for example. Mm. But I have to say, like, being a dark sky reserve, that's a little bit of an authority as well.
Sure.
And it's also like a combination. And what I do, and this is like something I'm very proud of, is that we really convinced our municipalities to put let's put it like this. If you look into light pollution, you have got two dimensions. One dimension is trying to avoid light pollution in the future. That's one dimension mm-hmm. in time.
Sure.
And the other dimension is improving bad light, which has already been installed.
Sure.
So, and I try to look into both directions, obviously. And looking into the future, we created very good planning aids for mm-hmm. like municipalities, for architects, for planners, for homeowners and all these things. They are very technical and explain a lot. And they are used all over the place in Germany. I'm very glad about it. And as I said before, it has been published by an authority, which makes it a bit more authority-ly in this sense. And the good thing is, the technical guidelines or the technical specifications we put into the planning aids can be used to be enforced via building land development plans. You know what I mean? When you have land gets developed. Yeah.
Sure.
And this is actually, if a and in Germany, it's like this, that the municipalities make these land development plans. And if they put in our technical specifications to reduce light, that's law. Yeah, so we make mm-hmm. law in that way using land development plans, and now we're into like lighting ordinances and making municipality light in Germany is a municipality thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you need to convince the mayor, you need to convince the representative, you need to
mm-hmm.
Convince in a way the people living there. I mean, due to the energy crisis we have. Although, you know, light pollution is always a waste of energy, but because mm-hmm. of the war, the Russian war in the Ukraine, we have a bit of an energy crisis and a lot of municipalities switch off now at night. It's like a kind of what? So the things
sure.
we've been fighting for so many years, we can't do that. Suddenly we can, because electricity has become very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And the municipalities, they are checking like, where can we save money and energy and CO2, as you and I know. And and a lot of municipalities now in our dark sky reserve start switching off the night at light, the light at night, like at 11 o'clock. So in this way, well, it's a shame that we need a war to switch off the light at night. Yeah, so that this is like the things looking into the future, trying to avoid light pollution, and looking backwards, trying to optimize. That's a little bit harder, obviously, because of the constitutional law that you can't really force people, unless they break the law, to change their lights if they don't want to. But I've got a really cool thing, and that might be an inspiration for all the listeners. The Chamber of Commerce in our place kind of likes our Sternenpark, our Dark Sky Reserve, and we created together an award. It is called Light Awareness Award. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the main polluters are obviously not homeowners, because they have neighbors and try to be careful with neighbors. But the main source of light pollution is industry and commercial light. Mm-hmm. And by creating this award, Light Awareness Award, together with the Chamber of Commerce, we have a completely new access to the main polluters, because it's not like the authority or the green people, it's the Chamber of Commerce who wants the companies to reduce light pollution. Mm-hmm. And that's really, really good. And we've already reached a lot with that.
Fabulous.
And that's really, really great. And the boss of the Chamber of Commerce, he is really proud of it. And he tells his other Chamber of Commerce, like, we've done something really cool. Because the thing is, many commercial companies, they have on their websites, like, they do a lot of for sustainability and biodiversity. But you and I know, looking at the dark side, they all have a blind spot. And so we use that and saying, you can't just doing a lot for climate and doing a lot for biodiversity, and at night you just spill light all over the place. And but as I said, it's not like me coming like, it's a Chamber of Commerce, and we're quite successful, I have to say.
You know, I believe in that. I think that persuasion and convincing are far more powerful than I like the word persuasion, because you bring people to your perspective. You share, you're not forcing them. I think you're inviting them to join an environmental movement. I feel that the darkness restoration movement is an environmental issue on par with plastics in the ocean, CO2, biodiversity. It's not a metaphor. It's not a metaphor, light pollution. It's a real thing. And of all of those problems that we talked about, this is a solvable problem. We can fix most of it.
Yes, we could, yeah. looking at light pollution and turning the time back, when we first started off with our Dark Sky Reserve, the LED, the lighting, the LED, was not as, not as much as on the market as it is now. Mm-hmm. So when we started off, we looked at the illumination of sporting fields, football fields, mm-hmm. churches, and streetlights, yeah? Mm-hmm. And these days, we're looking at gardens, yeah? Who would have thought that light, travels into the garden, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Because people start illuminating their houses, started
the trees.
The trees and all these things, and and so you need to, at the same time as you try to persuade the people, something new is on the market coming from China being cheap. So I would have never thought so, but I agree with you. At the same time, I have partners like in the Nature Conservation mm-hmm. Associations here, and they actually sometimes get really angry with light pollution, and then they're the bad guys. Yeah, so we play a bit of good guy and get guy, bad guy.
Yeah, sometimes you need the carrot and the stick, right, for the donkey, right? Sometimes you need both. I agree with that. But you know, because the donkey, you know, wants to go in the same direction, round and round in circles. He doesn't have a problem with that, right? But when you try to take the donkey off the wheel and walk him down the road, maybe he doesn't want to go in this direction or that direction, and he needs a carrot hung in front of him, and sometimes he needs a whack in the butt to go. So yeah, I think it's a two-pronged strategy with enforcement and persuasion and advocacy, and both sides of the argument are very important to build momentum and to get people adopting it on their own. And then there's the stragglers that are left that need a little bit of enforcement to help them along. My concern, you know, whenever I speak to people on the podcasts I do, and I do a lot of podcasts on the lighting industry and dark skies in this arena, 3-4 a week, what I notice is there's a lot of focus on on development, on new construction, and how much we can do in new development. But most buildings are already built, okay? That's going to be true forever, right? Most buildings are already built. And then you have like this balance between, like, if you've ever been on a river cruise on the Seine River in France and you see the Eiffel Tower, it's absolutely spectacularly gorgeous when it's lit up at night. Okay, and I know people can say, you know, hey, I don't like it or whatever. So there's going to be this push and pull. What I like about the municipalities, and it may have come from war. I mean, I hate to say that, you know, that we came to a place we wanted to get to for the wrong reasons. You know, we got here because we ran out of money for electricity, and so we had to shut the lights off. But you know, I don't have a problem with, you know, maybe shutting lights off at 11 o'clock and maybe enforcing that.
Yeah. Well, you see, that's very funny because before the war, municipalities switched here off as well, mainly because of money reasons and saving money. But they did. And obviously there was a lot of objection because people are so detached from natural darkness that I think... they get robbed and all these things, which is all rubbish, as we know. And so they switched off beforehand as well. It's just like now with the war, more municipalities switch off. And the funny thing is, last year or the last couple of years, I get a lot of citizens saying, we want more life quality by switching off. Yeah, so people in our area, but that's because we've been doing 10 years all this awareness thing. So, and people here now see it as light. What is artificial light? It's just artificial light. It's not more. It's just like boring artificial light. And I feel deprived of darkness. And other people feel deprived of darkness as well. I most certainly feel deprived of darkness when I walk through a street and there's street lights. And anyway, and we talk about like 11 o'clock or so. And I'm really, really happy that more and more people in our area, at least, see it as an improvement of life quality, saying I'd rather sit on my balcony and have the insect in my garden than flying around the lamp. Mm-hmm. Or I'd rather have no street light shining into my sleeping room. And I really liked it because there was like people writing the mayor, please switch off the lights at night.
Sure.
And so they do. Yeah. We have a couple of villages who actually, reached that aim.
That is so wonderful. You know, there was almost, you know, and I hate to say that the pandemic or COVID or whatever you want to call it, but there was a sense going into COVID of this pulsing, constant expansion and 24/7 work and people, I don't think grocery stores need to be open at 3 a.m. I don't think they need to be open at 11 o'clock at night. I don't think people need to be having jobs that are, you know, and I'm not saying that those jobs are not valuable. Now, do we need emergency workers? Do we need doctors and hospitals to be open at night? Of course we do. But do we need, you know, 24/7 gas stations with 100 lux beneath the gas and big bright signs scattering sky glow out to the universe forever? No, I don't think we need that. I think especially in these smaller rural towns, you know, one of the things that I sold the house recently and we had a lighting put into the soffits, which was, you know, a very slim a spotlight that shined down on the house. And the purchaser knew this, and they kept coming by at 11 or 12 o'clock at night to see the lights on my house. And they said, well, you know, as part of the deficiencies in the sale, they said, no, the soffit lighting doesn't work because every time I come by your house at night, the soffit lighting is off. And I said, that's because I only have it on for 2 hours after sunset. So, you know, it stays on for 2 hours and then goes off. And I don't think you need to have your house illuminated at 3 a.m.
Right.
Without
illuminate houses anyway. I'm not a church. Yeah. So.
No, but you see it. You see it in towns, like in my town, you see people with very ostentatious outdoor lighting on their houses and trees and all this sort of stuff. And yeah, does it look nice sometimes? Sure. But why does it need to be on at 11 o'clock at night? Isn't it time to turn it? You're not having a party. You don't have, you know, people. Like if you had a party and you wanted to leave it on one night till 12 or 1 o'clock, fine. But most, it's a bit ostentatious to use that much electricity and light your house up all night long.
That's LED. This is what the LED did. Because everything that gets cheap gets overused. If this is like flying, if this is meat, if this is like cruises on big ships, yeah. So, but we kind of built our society on consumerism, and so we need to work like 24/7, and obviously it does the people's head in. Yeah, and there's a really very good guy talking about, he's a sleep scientist, yeah, mm-hmm. Albrecht Foster is his name, another German guy, but he really says what it does when people work at night, how it affects them for even later in their life. Yeah. And as you said, we need emergency people. But at the same time, well, our whole business is built up on that. Yeah. And so I call my I'm a climate activist as well and a vegan for all good reasons in this world. Don't eat any animal stuff. But I call my starguiding tours climate-friendly far-distance travels, because obviously we can see Andromeda, mm-hmm. Andromeda Galaxy with the mm-hmm. naked eye, and that's 2.5 million light years away from us. So I call this like it's a very climate-friendly journey. And and I try to make people do that. And obviously we realize the climate change in Europe as well, because with the horrible drafts in the summer and no night sky at all in the winter because it's all cloudy and rainy. And but I don't know if people actually get convinced that less is more. Less light pollution is more stars, obviously.
Well, you know, I don't, I think there's a difference in mindset to people who live in Canada, the United States, and Europe. And I think we're seeing a transitioning in North America towards a European thought process. But I'm not sure I like it. And one of those thought processes that there's a limit to what we can achieve, or there's some sort of we must suffer, or we need to be hyper efficient, or these kinds of things, which I work in the energy efficiency business. I work in the waste management business every day. Okay, so I'm not saying that I don't subscribe to these a default to efficiency or and that, but I don't think we can mitigate our way out of our problems, like by being cheap. I think we need clean electricity, and we can use as much of it as we want to use. Okay,
yeah, I'm a bit scared of it.
Why? Well, this is where people are like, well, why would you want to use as much as you want? Like, what are you, some kind of electricity pig? No, it's just that being able to use as much electricity as clean electricity as I want is what I want to do, right? Like
as long as it doesn't mean more artificial light. Yeah.
Well, here's my next point is this. There's absolutely no reason for light pollution. Like, we can solve most of our light pollution problems with technology. It's not an engineering issue. It's not a deployment issue. It's simply the will to do it. That's all it is.
Just switch off.
Yeah. Switching off is like the number one thing. But even in areas where we need lighting, because there are going to be areas where we need electric light at night. It's going to be, areas. We have the technology to eliminate the sky glow portion of it, and the simple shielding, color temperatures, all this sort of stuff would solve a lot of problems. So there's no excuse for it. And so I'm an advocate for that. And I think that, you know, we need to deploy these technologies. The final point on that, Sabine, that I've been saying, and Scott's going to tell me that I've said this too many times on the show, but this is represents the single largest, I know that you're not so into the business side of it, but it's a massive opportunity for the lighting industry to make a ton of money. Like, I hate to say it, but that means that every light fixture outside is now available to be adjusted, replaced, lighting controls. The absolute number one case for lighting controls is within the darkness restoration movement across the world, mm-hmm. where we deploy these technologies to turn off, dim. You know, they've done studies already that if you dim lights, outdoor lights by 50% and change the color from 5,000K to 2,200K Whoa. Over the course of half an hour, nobody mm-hmm. even notices. Nobody even notices.
The eye can't. Exactly. You see, you would like the lamp. It's just having sunset. Yeah, it's getting dark here. Mm-hmm. And I've got a 2,200K just outside my window. And that gets reduced to 50%, I think, in 2 hours. Yeah.
Yeah. So people don't even notice.
And obviously, we saw that doing the conversions in our place, that light pollution did reduce. We saw that.
How do you measure light pollution?
We've got a measurement network. Yeah, it's called we use not SQM. You know the SQM handheld. You probably mm-hmm. know. Yeah, mm-hmm. the sky quality meter. We don't use that. We use TESS. It has been developed by the University of Madrid. It's kind of the same thing. It's a photo lens measuring light pollution. And we live rural, but we have quite a big city, not far from here, which is called Fulda. And Fulda is next to Flagstaff, dark sky city number 2 in the world. Mm-hmm. And so we've got a measuring network from reaching from Fulda into the most rural places of the mountain range Rhön. And so we measure that. Yeah. And also what else we do is we take pictures on a regular basis and use satellites using Chris Kuiper's help.
Sure.
You know Chris. And sure. We can actually see that in some places light pollution definitely got reduced.
But there isn't a standard measurement worldwide, is there, for light pollution measuring?
No, not yet. Yeah.
So there's two ways. There's two ideas from it. One of them is to look down from either space or air balloons, yeah. right? And these are usually yeah. lighting people that want to do this. So lighting people want to look at the lights, right? Yeah. And astronomers say, no, you don't have to do that. You just need to look at the sky.
Yeah. And also the vertical illumination. Yes. Yeah.
I think we need
that's what we found out with Chris, yeah, that we tried, we walked around with an app, counting and documenting all lighting fixtures we saw, and mm-hmm. then we tried to correlate it with satellite pictures, and we see it just doesn't work. Yeah, because and also the measuring, we can see that with our light, with our test network, it really depends on so many factors. It's like the moon, obviously. It's the Milky Way. Yeah. And also it's moisture. Yeah. It's mm-hmm. all kind of things that affects measuring. I find really, really difficult. And after having been doing that for so many years, I'm convinced digital cameras are probably the best, using a sky meter program showing with the colors. And also, you know, Scott, what is it worth to have like a kind of SQM magnitude thingy? I go to a mayor and I tell him, look, in your municipality, it's 19.8, yeah, blah, blah. Exactly. Yeah. So, and obviously seeing is believing, and mm-hmm. to make light pollution visible, that's something that convinces the mayors more than some, you know, fancy numbers.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. Sabine, is there any final, we're coming up on 45 minutes, if you can believe it. Is there any final thoughts you have for the Restoring Darkness listeners that you want to tell them?
What can I tell them? Well, just hello darkness, enjoy the darkness. I'm like not very good with words of how to describe how inspiring, of course, fascinating, calming the darkness is. I sometimes get asked, what is so fascinating about it? I just can't describe it. It's just my simple awe. I get off the bus and I could walk down the road which is lit up, and I always choose the road which is not lit up, and I just love it. And yeah, it's just restore darkness.
So we were just recording this after, because we, Sabine and I, started talking about this, so we're going to pack this on to the end of the show. And Sabine was just telling me that there's no law in Germany that says that a street has to be lit. That is so interesting, because here's the problem with the regulatory side of this, which is like, oh, if something happens and you went dark sky friendly, then you could be liable for a lawsuit or something like this in Canada. Like, let's say, I wonder to myself if the problem
is like that.
Hang on, let me just make my point. I wonder if the problem comes in when you actually install electric light, then it's subject to codes and tolerances and certain amounts of light. But if you don't install a light at all, there's no regulation on that. Right? It's like that's non-regulated. There's just no light fixed, or, you know, there's no light there. So then this is governed by this set of codes. And, oh, but if there is a light there, well, then you need 20, you need 0.5 foot candles, minimum average. You need this, you need that, you need this. And it has to do this, and it has to be that, and it has to be this high, and whatever. Like, it's if you install the lights, now you're in trouble. But if you don't install the lights, then there may be no regulation. Yeah. That's super interesting. That is very interesting.
Well, yes and no. So the thing is, there is no such law in Germany saying that you have to light up the road. Mm-hmm. And I have some municipalities, well, actually the Rhön, our area, has got parts in Bavaria, in Hessian, where I live, mm-hmm. and in the eastern part of Germany, Thuringia. And there are villages that don't even have street lights, yeah? And they don't even want street lights because they're not used to it. And also what you say, it's like, In our place, kind of true, because if the municipality decides to put up light, they sometimes use industry rules, but they don't have to. So they might put up a candle if they want to.
Sure.
And that's what I try to do with my municipalities. I try to free them from a ghost telling them you have to light up the roads, otherwise you're liable, because you're not liable. The thing is, if something happens on the road, maybe even during daytime, there's a lot of accidents, and you couldn't blame the sun for that, because at daytime, it was the sun's fault, not mine.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
It's so true.
Yes, and the thing is, there's like more, there is other reasons, a much better measurements to make the road safe. That's, for example, reducing speed, for example, yeah? Making better markings on the right.
We can reflect it, reflective markings.
Exactly. Use reflecting markings.
Photoluminescent strips. Yeah, there's all sorts of things you can do.
Exactly. There's so many alternatives to light.
Sure.
And that's what I do. That's why I'm a deal illuminator. I try to convince them to not put up light. Just at a few places, or I don't really get it why to light up the streets. The modern headlights of cars, they just like illuminate to the left and to the right 10-20 meters, and so I try to convince them to just light up the pavement where people walk, so you need to illuminate less space. And so I don't think industry likes me. And who is liable if something happens? Well, it's the person taking part in traffic.
That's not 100% true. I'm involved in a court case in Ontario right now, where a pedestrian was struck and killed on a on ramp to the highway. Now, it took place during the day, okay, but because I spoke to the lawyer, because the crossing wasn't constructed properly and the signage wasn't properly done for pedestrian yield crossing. So this was a crossing where pedestrians are allowed to cross, but they have to yield to cars It's not a vehicle yield crossing. So they didn't do the signage right. That meant that the province, the region, and the city and the town were all sued as well in this lawsuit. And I wondered to myself, if they had a light there, that then, again, if there was no light, maybe it's good. But if there's not enough light, or they put the wrong light or whatever, that gets added into this lawsuit and sabotages our movement, our darkness movement, which is something that really concerns me, is that there's a regulatory piece that we have to get right. But if this idea where, hey, there's areas of my region and my town which are not lit. These roads are not lit. So clearly there's some air allowance for not lighting up these roads. And perhaps that is universal across all roads, that they don't need to be lit up, but the regulations only come in when they are. The regulations only apply when you're starting to light them up. That's interesting.
But even with this pedestrian who got killed, in my opinion, you can't, if you are the pedestrian, you can't rely on lights, yeah, because you have to think that lights might not, I'd say they are not fault. I'd say it was the pedestrian fault walking, although cars are coming. So you just, that's why, you see, this is something we talked about earlier. How can it be that people look at lights crossing the road and not looking at the road crossing the light, the road. You know what I mean?
Sure.
This is like being stupid, just because there could also be a malfunction all the time. Mm. Yeah, I would never rely on a light because it's something electrical and something can go wrong. So I'd say, if I was a judge, I'd say it was the pedestrian's fault, because the pedestrian is the person taking part in the public. Have you ever been at night in a city or in a town when the light is switched off? Have you ever been?
Only in Europe, actually.
You know how magic that is. You are like, this is so magic. Like you are you know, that the little city or town,
sure,
like where I'm from, they switch off at night. And sure, if you're there at night and you have the stars and you have the houses and you have the trees,
yes,
and you have the church, yeah, and you have all the sure, how can I say, all the buildings, the supermarket and all,
sure,
this is so calming. And you walk through there, you don't feel insecure at all. Yeah, you just feel... Oh, no.
I think I experienced it once in Germany and once in Austria. So do you know the town Weißenkirchen in Austria?
No, I don't know.
It's like a mountain town, and it's like in the winery region of Austria. The Wachau. You know the Wachau? Am I pronouncing it right?
Wachau?
W-A-U-C-H-A-U. Wachau? Anyway,
and
then in another town called Bayersbronn in Germany. I think they switched off their lights.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in at night, and I remember being it's in the Black Forest. The Schwarzwald, yeah. Is that it? Schwarzwald?
Yeah. Schwarzwald, yeah. My mom's from there, yeah. Yeah.
So I remember, you know, getting into a cab, and everything was dark everywhere. Everything. When we were driving back to our resort or whatever, it was darkness everywhere. There was no lights on. Yeah. It was very magical, actually. I felt like I was,
exactly,
you know,
it's magic.
Julius Caesar, yeah, was going to come out of the woods and attack. You know, it's a very magical feeling to be there. I'll be honest with you, especially at night. Sabine, I'm going to let you go. It's 11 o'clock here. I'm sure it's 6 or 7 there. So we just had a little addendum here to start for the Restoring Darkness show. I think it was the best part, but I'll let you go. Bye for now.
Okay. Thanks a lot, and bye-bye.
Bye.
Restore Darkness. Bye.
Look no further for dark sky friendly products than Evluma. Since its first product launch, Evluma has carried one or more International Dark Sky Association certified models. If your customer cares about light pollution, suggest the OmniMax with shielding or the ArriaMax with full cutoff to reduce uplight and glare. Evluma, illuminating the pursuit of darkness.